brothers in the Dharma. It's really an honour to give a talk on an order weekend. It feels like a long time since I spoke on an order weekend. Actually, I did a sort of seminar in Sheffield a while back for a day, but this sort of feels a bit different. I mean, there's more of you for a start, and it's all Dharmacharis. Not that I've got anything against mixed order events or anything like that, but it feels weighty to me to be talking to you this morning. And it's also the fact that it's the order weekend that falls in our 40th anniversary year. So it feels sort of momentous for some reason. And the difficulty for me these days is that I'm finding it impossible to prepare talks. I just cannot write things down. I've got a few notes here just so that I don't go completely mad. So it's also slightly alarming these days to give a talk to a group of a discerning audience of Dharmacharis and in a way not be as prepared as I'd like to be. But I'll wind in and to the talk. On Tuesday night, Satyaraja and I returned from Guhyaloka, where we'd been ordaining people. I did three private ordinations. Satyaraja did two private ordinations and four public ordinations. And there's actually others here. Ratnagosha, Paramabandhu were also out there at Guhyaloka. I don't know if there's anybody else who were... Sorry?
Bodhivanksa,
yes, thank you. And it really was a wonderful 2 weeks of practice with the whole retreat. Yes, doing private ordinations again at Guhyaloka. I hadn't been there for 4 years. And as often happens with a private ordination, I've just become very aware of Bhante, very aware of my own ordination, which is actually 40 years ago in June. Ratnaguna and I were ordained on a weekend retreat in Thetford Forest in Broomhouse Farm. It was just before we'd bought Padmaloka, as I think might have been the last to be ordained at Broomhouse Farm. That seems to be quite an anniversary, 40 years of being an order member. So I was very, very aware of Bhante doing these ordinations, very aware of the lineage. When we have ordination kutis, as well as lots of images of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and an image of a photograph of Bhante, there's also images of Bhante's teachers, photos of his all of his teachers. And this, not just lineage in that sense, in the sense of being aware of his teachers, but, if you like, the Buddha lineage, the lineage of the Buddha sons that comes down to us, the lineage, if you like, of the three jewels. That becomes very, very strong, I think, at the time of ordination, that one feels very aware of, if you like, the stream of the tradition that you inherit, that I have inherited, that I'm wanting to pass on as well. Sometimes you can as well go through a bit of a crisis around the time of doing an ordination. You start questioning your own worthiness to be a preceptor, to witness somebody's ordination, or to receive somebody into the order in the case of a public preceptor. You can't not but feel your own sort of lack of real spiritual depth and understanding and insight, and but you can't but feel your own shortcomings, as indeed the people being ordained can often feel. But in a sense, you aren't doing it. You aren't doing it when you're ordaining. You're opening up to something much greater than yourself. You're opening up to the lineage of the Buddhas as it's come down into this world of ours and into this present time. You really do need to open up to that to feel that you're ordaining. It kind of happens. It happens in part, I think, because of the whole sort of atmosphere of the ordination retreat, particularly generated by the whole of the spiritual community, the whole Sangha present. One of the lovely features about the ordination course was the evening order meeting with all of the preceptors and the team running the retreat. This really wonderful, easy feeling between everybody. Order members who I haven't seen for years and years, just feeling this wonderful kind of rapport and sense of unity with them, that we're doing the same thing. And it occurred to me later, it's often occurred to me, that order members really are at their very best when they're benefiting others, when they're not only practicing intensively themselves, but when they're really united, working together for the benefit of others and passing on the flame of the Dharma to others. I sometimes think that we get into difficulties when we forget that ordination vow: for the benefit of all beings, I accept this ordination. And, you know, I think that whole sense of community really opens up that sort of higher dimension. You can sort of see in moments like this why Bhante would say that the bodhicitta is far more likely to arise within a community than within an individual. That it's something that inspires a community, and that the community together kind of opens up to something. And yet everybody's so distinctly, uniquely particular themselves. So yes, I couldn't help but be aware of Bhante, of lineage out there at Guhyaloka on that ordination retreat. And that's good to be put in touch with that when we had this, decided to have the theme of this weekend, the lineage of Sangharakshita. And I was thinking a bit about the lineage of Sangharakshita and the whole idea of lineage, because in a sense, Bhante hasn't said a lot about lineage. He said some things. He said something more particular about lineage in at a meeting of public preceptors some time ago now, back in Majjhima Loka, after the interview, What is the Western Buddhist Order? And in that question and answer session that we were having, he talked about three lineages that he's sort of transmitted, three and a sort of fourth. So the three lineages: the lineage of teachings, the teachings that he's given, his particular translation and interpretation of the Dharma, which of course has been added to by order members, of course firmly based on the teachings of the Buddha and, you know, some of the other, you know, the other great acharyas down the ages. So there's the lineage of teachings, and he said you keep that alive through study and through teaching. You have to keep these things alive. And then there's the lineage of practices, or the lineage of practice, which is the practices that Bhante has transmitted, the basic practices, which again, you know, order members will experience and even add to. And of course, you keep that alive again by practicing it yourself, but also transmitting it, communicating it. It's very interesting that in keeping it alive, it's not just about doing these things oneself. It's making it known, communicating it to others, handing it on. And then the lineage of inspiration, which is what I'm going to talk about. And I was just looking at my notes of this. I didn't have access to the... I don't even know if it was recorded. But he talked about the lineage of inspiration as coming from personal contact. It's from Bhante to his disciples, to others, and then, of course, others to others, and so on. And he said this lineage of inspiration is above and beyond the teaching and practice. It's that extra special something which can't really be pinned down, can't really be put into words, that particular kind of signature, flavour, perfume, taste that kind of permeates what we do, and of course really must inform the teachings the lineage of teachings and practices, if they're going to have any, you know, real vitality to them, if they're not just going to turn into dogmas or doctrines and simply techniques. They need to be enlivened by this lineage of inspiration. The fourth, he said he wasn't sure if he could quite call it a lineage, but I think it's being spoken of as a lineage now, is the lineage of institutions, structures, environments, the whole sort of body, if you like, through which the teachings and practices and inspirations can actually flow, and you know, how that can be, as it were, organised. Although with inspiration, you can't really organise inspiration. Inspiration is unorganisable, and I think that's very important. So that's what he said and he's probably said more things about these things. So I've got to give you a talk on the lineage of inspiration. And I have to say that's difficult because, like I said, I don't think you can really describe what inspiration is. I can't tell you what it is. I mean, inspiration is either there or it isn't there. I did a little bit of dictionary work. So I did do some preparation for this talk. You know, because Bhante, you know, would often go to the dictionary and I'm in his lineage. And inspiration, of course, means, it's related to the word inspire, breathing on or breathing into, which has, of course, connotations of giving life to. And we know, of course, it can mean so much more than that. But I like that. That which gives life, which really animates what we're doing in our Dharma life, what we're doing with others in our order, in our Dharma life. The living force, if you like, of inspiration. And we know only too well when that's not there, it's very, very difficult to keep going. You've got to make so much sort of effort, use so much will. I remember an early talk that Bhante, it wasn't a talk, it was when he was introducing some order members. I think it was Marlini maybe giving a talk on inspiration, and Bhante said you need three things to give a really good talk: inspiration, not defining what inspiration was. So yes, I've got to say something about inspiration, but like I say, I find it very hard to talk about it. Perhaps, by way of getting into this, let's stay with lineage for a bit. I want to stay with lineage. I associate lineage with inspiration. In a way, to speak of a lineage of inspiration is sort of, what's that? What, you're saying the same thing. What's the word?
Tautology.
It's a tautology, yes. Because I associate a sense of lineage with inspiration. When I'm inspired, I feel in touch with a stream of something which is associated with people or with beings. Inspiration doesn't, as it were, come out of nowhere. For me, it's always associated with somebody, a person, a living being, an archetype, something like that. I'm not saying that it's always got to be like that. That's what it's like for me. And it's very interesting, when I first came along to the movement, I was, you know, my head was full of Tibetan Buddhism. The first books that I'd read at the tender age of 16 and 17 were Lama Govinda's wonderful books on Tibetan Buddhism, Foundations of Tibetan Mysticism and The Way of the White Clouds. And of course, there's so much emphasis on the guru and the lineage and this whole sense of the Dharma being transmitted person to person, the Dharma being embodied in a man, in a person, and that something is communicated of enormous transformative power to the disciple. Lama Govinda, you know, with that wonderful sort of German romanticism of his, you know, really brings that alive so strongly, particularly in The Way of the White Clouds. And I found that extremely attractive. Extremely attractive. I think for both good and bad reasons. I think the good reasons was in part to do with sort of personal experience, to do with, you know, early quotes, you know, sounds terribly grandiose, mystical experience, which always seemed to be involving a kind of, if you like, a kind of wordless prayer, a wordless flow from the heart up into the firmament, and a response, a kind of response from something beyond, there being a sort of communication going on. So it would be natural for me to be very attracted to a presentation of the Dharma of Buddhism, which involved both devotion, in the case of Lama Govinda talking about the disciple, and a response, you know, from the guru, from the Lama, from the teacher. And that in that communication, something of great transformative power is invoked. It really wasn't surprising. I think the negative side, and I think it's very important for me to acknowledge this so we don't get carried away, was a passivity and even a laziness. Because I think, you know, if I'm honest, you know, that one of the attractions of getting into Buddhism was that I wouldn't have to work. You know, I could spend my life meditating and hopefully meet a guru who'd give me that special mantra, that special, you know, technique, which with the minimal amount of effort would somehow click all the, you know, do something to all the chakras, precipitating full and complete enlightenment. No, the bodhicitta, to work for the benefit of all beings, but with the minimal amount of effort involved. Just sailing along to nirvana for the benefit of all beings. So there's a slightly, you know, let's be open to that sort of side of things. The near enemy, if you like. But I think there's also something just tremendously positive as well in my younger self, which has never gone away, is still present in terms of that attitude, in terms of the way I approach practice. You know, I could say to the chaps I was ordaining, well, do your sadhana every day. I've done my sadhana every day. There probably have been some lapses over the last 40 years, but most days I've done my sadhana. Most days I've visualised Padmasambhava, I've said the mantra, because that is the way Dharma life presents itself to me, with ideally an intensity of faith and devotion and an opening to a person, to a presence, to an embodiment of wisdom and compassion and, you know, all of the other qualities. It's the way I'm made, the way I'm built. So yes, naturally, I'd be very attracted to lineage. And so that when I heard that lecture of Bhante's, the symbolism of the cosmic refuge tree and the archetypal guru, which is in the Tantric Path series, which describes the Padmasambhava refuge tree and then ends with a magnificent evocation of Guru Yoga from the Tabe de Lam, the smooth road to emancipation. I was completely electrified when I heard his description of that. It's a magnificent description describing how you begin by transforming yourself into a mass of light. And then you become Vajrayogini herself, imagining your teacher above your head, then Padmasambhava, thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara, Amitabha. And then you entreat intensely for their blessings and that you may gain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. And then through various visualizations, you unite fully with the guru, who has now been completely, as it were, united with the tree kaya above him, Padmasambhava, Avalokiteshvara and Amitabha. When I heard that, I knew I wanted to do that practice. I was going to do that practice. This is the way I wanted to live and be. I was inspired just hearing Bhante's description about it. And indeed, after ordination, Bhante did edit the practice for me, and I used to have a handwritten copy of it, beautifully handwritten. It's now, I think, lodged in the Order Library, because I passed it on to Suvadra many years ago. And I did do that practice, but I did get into difficulties with it, and I had to sort of put it down because it was adversely affecting my relationship with Bhante. I was seeing him more as a sort of guru thing for me rather than as a person, as a human being that I needed to be aware of and treat as a person in order to be genuinely open to what he was communicating to me. And there was a very painful period in my order life where every time I went to Bhante with the guru thing attitude, I got the black light Teflon treatment, the black air, the black energy treatment that, as Chogyam Trungpa, I think, calls it, where basically Bhante ignored me. And if we did talk about something, like I asked something about a particular sort of juicy aspect of Vajrayana practice, he would explain it to me in such a sort of bored and sort of throwaway fashion that I felt sort of grubby by the end of it. So I had to drop that, but I still do this practice, this guru yoga sometimes. There is a tremendous richness of it in it, and I was reflecting a few years ago on something that Bhante said. Just, you know, so often with Bhante, he makes these comments which you don't notice at the time, because he doesn't say, "And now I'm going to make a really important point." Sometimes he does that, but he just says things and you sort of miss them. And one of the things he said in that lecture, he said the idea of lineage, well, he said it isn't just an idea. It's not just a nice idea to think that your teacher is the disciple of that teacher and you can trace it all back to the Buddha. And in fact, when you actually look into the lineages that are so prized, the paramparas, as they're called, the traditional term, so prized, particularly in Tibetan Buddhism, and when you look into them, actually, they're very tenuous indeed. There's a very good scholar of Indian and Tibetan Buddhism named Ronald Davidson, who really does show, you know, how thin the lineages really are. He says it doesn't mean that the people who are the products of these sort of imagined lineages aren't, in some cases, outstanding practitioners, but they furnish themselves with lineages very often. It isn't necessarily there anyway. But Bhante said the idea of lineage is something that you need to experience. I would say that you need to activate it. You need to activate a sense of lineage. It's not about... I remember in the old days bumping into friends who got involved with Tibetan Buddhist gurus, and they'd go on and on and on about lineage, and it was, "My guru's bigger than your guru, and you haven't really got one," and you think, hang on, there's something wrong here. This is about status. This is about power. This isn't really to do with a genuine sense of lineage. Bhante said it's something you activate. You activate it through your sense of faith, through your sense of devotion, through your sense of real connectedness with the tradition going back to the Buddha. You activate it in that way. That's how you have a sense of the continuity of the tradition. And in the Guru Yoga itself, it's very interesting, some of the little instructions you have in it, after you've imagined yourself as Vajrayogini. And Vajrayogini here is really the image of the archetypal disciple. This is really important. I mean, some people are into Vajrayogini, and sometimes you wonder if it's just because they want a sort of archetypal version of a sort of topless go-go dancer with skulls and knives and something like that. That is really seriously missing the point of these figures on any level. In this practice, she is the archetypal disciple. In a way, it doesn't matter whether or not you visualize yourself as Vajrayogini. What you've got to get in touch with is what a real disciple is. When you get in touch with what a real disciple is, then you can actually discover the lineage. Then, actually, I think you can discover the lineage of inspiration. And, of course, she's red and naked and all this sort of thing. In the practice, after you've done that and you've imagined the lineage above your head, and it's this particular lineage, you know, of your teacher and the Trikaya above him, you're seeing him as a kind of emanation of the Trikaya. Before you say this very, very intense, very strong, urgent verse about gaining enlightenment for the benefit of all, expressed in a particular kind of Ati Yoga path form, won't go into that, it says you should recite it humbly, devotedly, fervently, and single-mindedly. So I thought what I would do in trying to talk about the lineage of inspiration, and it's not so much talking about what that is, but how do we connect with inspiration? And I think these particular phrases, humbly, devotedly, fervently, and single-mindedly, might give us a clue to how we might open up to the lineage of inspiration. So I'm going to talk about being humble. I'm going to talk about devotion. I'm going to talk about fervour. And I'm going to talk about single-mindedness. Briefly. So first of all, humble. Humble. Gosh, it's again one of those difficult ones, because I don't think you can, if you self-consciously make yourself humble, you're in Uriah Heep land, aren't you? You know, very humble and so on. That's not really what is meant here. What it is getting at is that you recognise that you are lower, and the teacher, the teachers, the lineage, the tradition is higher and greater than you. That's what it really means. Is that, in other words, you've got a deep and real and genuine sense of spiritual hierarchy. Not a hierarchy, of course, of power, not a hierarchy of people having won over on you, not something that you resent or anything like that, but you genuinely do see and feel and believe and know that your teacher, your Kalyana Mitras, the Buddhas, are really greater, much, much greater than you. Much, much greater than me. I know this is well-rehearsed territory, this sense of spiritual hierarchy, but I wonder if we really take it seriously. I wonder how deep it goes in us emotionally, how much we realise that we really don't know, that we really are lost in samsara, that we really are very, very deeply attached to this world, and that we really don't actually truly acknowledge that the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, the tradition as it comes down to us, really does embody something much greater and the real answers to our circumstances and our situation. If you cling to this life, you are not a Dharmachari. So says the great Sakya in the first of the parting from the four attachments. When you become humble, you've really recognised that you don't have a clue, that you really are lost, and that the whole samsaric approach to things really doesn't work. And actually, the Buddha, your teacher, the tradition really does have the answers. So this brings up not just humility, it brings up receptivity. I mean, it's another one of those, isn't it? Dharmic receptivity, spiritual receptivity. We've heard a lot about that recently. Again, I think I've been disappointed with a lot of the presentations about spiritual receptivity, because it sounds to me as though what the main project is to be receptive to yourself. When people have led just sitting and these sorts of practices, I hear a lot about, you know, really being aware of yourself and listening to yourself. Actually, no. Spiritual receptivity is about listening to the Buddha, listening to the teacher, listening to the tradition. The first of the prajñas, which is actually the most important in many ways, I think, for us. Shuttamaya prajña is the wisdom, the learning, the knowledge that comes through hearing. And shutta has connotations. It's not just, you know, turning up to hear a talk. You've decided that this man teaching, the Buddha, or Bhante, or whoever it might be, is an authority for you. Not authority in the power sense, but you have real faith. You know, that they really are saying something of great value, of great moment, of great importance. And you're putting aside your opinions, you're putting aside your subjectivity and your narcissism, and you are listening. You're taking in. And a lot of talk about insight and wisdom at the moment, and a lot of emphasis on seeing and knowing. I think it would be better if the emphasis was on listening. That very receptive, sort of feminine mode of really hearing the teaching, really hearing the word of the Buddha. Sometimes I almost feel that there are dogmas also coming into our meditation teaching. I just get this off my chest. I keep hearing all this stuff about, you know, being in your body and knowing the wisdom in your body. Well, there's truth in that. But for me, I think the strongest moments where I feel I've neared wisdom and insight is when I've really read and heard a verse from the Dhammapada. When that's gone right to the heart. I remember when I first heard, others do not realize that we're all heading for death. Those who do realize it will compose their quarrels. I heard that first in India when Bhante was giving a lecture at a memorial service for a Mitra who died suddenly. He gave an exposition of that verse. I'd never heard it before. And I knew it was true. I knew this connection being made between knowing that I would die, that others would die, would lead to the ending of quarrels, which means, of course, would lead to metta, which would lead to love. I knew then that the Buddha was enlightened. I thought to myself, anybody who can have such an elegant, simple truth, know that truth, see that truth, must be enlightened. Now that, I didn't experience it in my body, in my big toe. I just knew it directly. So let's, when we're looking at the whole business of wisdom, let's be open to hearing and listening what the Buddha actually says, what Bhante actually says. Let's be genuinely receptive. And genuinely receptive means as well, going back to what I was saying about really knowing that we don't know, is developing a real mood of sadness. Sadness. This is something that you get in the, not just in the Tibetan tradition, you find it in other places. It's a kind of domanassa. Even the Buddha talks about this in the Pali Canon, that sadness in the sense of a deep sorrow that you are a long, long way from enlightenment. We have this genre in Tibetan Buddhism that the cry of longing to the guru from afar. And the mood is one of immense sadness about the state of samsara. Not just your samsara, but the whole of it. And you're really developing this mood of tremendous longing to actually listen to the teaching, hear the liberating teaching, practice the Dharma, see the Buddha. Remember that wonderful verse, chapter in the Sutra of Golden Light, which is describing that by the Bodhisattva, the goddess Bodhisattva Samuchaya. Give me the cool water of your appearance, O conqueror. Gladden me with your compassion. This tremendous sense of seeing through samsara and opening, really opening to what is really the answer to it all. So that's a little bit on humility. devotion. Devotion is the next kind of mood you need to generate to open up to inspiration. Devotion is this intense love, isn't it, for the divine, speaking broadly. It's bhakti in Sanskrit, although the word bhakti, the Pali form of it, is actually first mentioned in the Theragata. It's first mentioned in Indian religious writing. It's described as devotion to the Dhamma, bhakti. So it's there. It's there in Buddhism. And, of course, it gets taken up later in a text like the Bodhicharavatara of Shantideva, where he talks about in devotion, in bhakti, I become your servant, I become your slave in worshipping the Buddha. So it's very strong. We shouldn't think that bhakti was a sort of Hindu thing which Buddhists borrowed. It was probably the other way round, in actual fact. Some people think that the whole image worship tradition of waking up the image and of making food offerings and all the intense devotion actually started with Buddhists. Because it was all a continuation of the recollection of the Buddha practice that developed. You wanted to bring the Buddha close. You wanted to remember the Buddha. So you lived as if the Buddha was always present before you. And when the images came, well, the Buddha was present before you in the old Indian monasteries. The cells are around a sort of quadrangle, I think, with the Buddha at the centre. Who would be strongly worshipped. So don't think I'm laying some Hinduism on you by talking about bhakti. Yes, which is a very difficult word to translate. I've been reading a very interesting history of bhakti in India by an American academic. Very, very fine book called A Storm of Songs. But bhakti is notoriously difficult to translate as a word. Yes, love, devotion, adoration, but it covers a whole range from sober veneration to sort of frenzied ecstasy. I think we're Buddhists are probably more towards the sober veneration end, although perhaps, you know, blocked Western Buddhists might need a little bit more of the go moving towards the frenzied ecstasy range, maybe. Perhaps, debatable. But bhakti also, it comes from a root meaning having a share in. It's the same root as in Bhagavan, as in Bhagavan Buddha, which means having a share in qualities. That's the way Bhante translates Bhagavan, richly endowed one who has a share in positive qualities. But Bhante also says that to call the Buddha Bhagavan means that you're seeing him as the supreme object of devotion. All of your love is for the Buddha. And we've tended in the movement to sort of play down devotion. You know, faith and commitment and going for refuge are more important. Quite rightly, we don't want just devotees, we want disciples. But you know, a disciple is also a devotee. Somebody who goes for refuge to the Buddha, who is a disciple of the Buddha, is also a devotee of the Buddha, in the sense of loves the Buddha, adores the Buddha, wants to be near to the Buddha, in a sense has a share in the Buddha. If bhakti means to have a share in, it means we have a share in the blessings of the Buddha. There's some part of us that is longing to be the Buddha, longing to unite with the Buddha. He is, after all, a human being as we are human beings. In that sense, we have a share in the Buddha. He is our natural ideal, as Bhante used to say back in the days of the ideal of human enlightenment. The enlightenment isn't an artificial ideal. The fullness of wisdom and love and liberation and all the other qualities, that's not something that's aberrant. It grows out of our humanness. It's the full flowering, the full unfolding of the lotus of our humanness. So devotion, I think, is a way of connecting with that. I know for myself that my own meditation practice, I'm only sort of just working this out, but my own meditation practice is very strongly devotionally led. I can't meditate without devotion. Maybe I've got a problem, but unless there is that connection, that loving connection to what is beyond, meditation is always a dry technique. And I wonder actually if there are quite a lot of people who are longing to meditate with a strong devotional element, or devotion being a part of how they practice. So I think devotion is a very, very important part. If we're going to call down the lineage of inspiration, there needs to be this sense of devotion. Of course, what also goes with devotion is happiness. When one is really in that mood of devotion, when faith and devotion are united, it's a state of, well, transport, of ecstasy, of real happiness. You know, you really feel that you're living fully and deeply from and for what is most important in life. It's so important to be in touch with that quality of devotion. The word bhakti also, I said it means it comes from a root to have a share in. Well, this American scholar, John Stratton Hawley, I think his name is, he said it also means that for bhaktas, traditionally in India, the different sort of bhakti movements, they have a share in each other. They have a share in each other. It's not just simply the bhakta is for the Bhagawan. It's also this sense of shared love with the brothers and sisters who share that transcendent devotion. Happy is the unity of the Sangha. Happy is the spiritual effort of the united, says the Buddha in the Dhammapada, in the Buddha Vagga, in the section of the Enlightened One. I think so wonderful. Again, insight. Happy is the unity of the Sangha. Happy is the spiritual effort of the united. Coming together in loving devotion, you connect so strongly with each other. And in having that devotion to the Buddha, to the source of inspiration, you become even more united, as I experienced strongly at Gukhiloka and in so many other places. So inspiration then isn't a sort of just simply personal thing. We open up to inspiration through this strong sense of sharing with one another. The word for spiritual effort, Bhante translates as spiritual effort, is of course tapas, tapo, which means, tapasya of course is the old word for asceticism, but it means literally making heat. Vajrayogini is red and, you know, all the flames and all the rest of it. Making heat, we need to make heat in our practice. So the next quality that you have to bring down inspiration is fervour. This is really an un-English talk, isn't it? Fervour. Ooh, got to be careful, you might become a religious maniac. Fervour, which actually comes from a word meaning fire. Making heat. Look, you know, it's very simple. We really aren't going to get anywhere, I don't think, unless we are making heat in our Dharma life, individually and collectively. The Buddha talks about this. There's that wonderful sutta where he talks about meditation as being like a mother hen making heat on top of the eggs, bringing about the birth of the little chicks, breaking out of the membrane, the shell of ignorance. He said, that's what we're doing ourselves. We're making heat to give birth to a new being. I don't know what the Tibetan was for fervour. They certainly say in Tibetan Buddhist texts, they talk about, not just about faith, they talk about fierce faith. You know, that if you're really going to practice, if you're really going to do it, if you really want to invoke the sources of inspiration, I was reading a commentary on the famous seven-line prayer to Padmasambhava, the White Lotus prayer. They say, well, you've got to go away. You've got to go away to a remote place. You make offerings and you chant this with tears running down your face, with tremendous longing, with a fierce faith, a fiery faith, you know, an aroused faith that Padmasambhava really will come to you, really will teach you, really will show you how to gain enlightenment, really will save you. This is the way they talk. You should chant until your voice breaks. No, they don't sort of say, yeah, but be careful, you're not willful. They don't add that. They talk like this sort of ferocity of practice. This intensity of practice. And I think that, you know, when we're deploring our lack of inspiration and we're not in touch with the lineage of inspiration, well, how fierce is our faith? You know, how fiery is it? How much are we really living from it? How much do we really believe in what we're doing? So fierce faith. And then finally, single-mindedly. You have to say this prayer to the Guru single-mindedly. So if we want to invoke inspiration, we have to be single-minded, wholehearted, all of ourselves involved. Again, you read Tibetan meditation texts, they often talk about you must strive with utter concentration. Not just Tibetan, this is throughout the Buddhist tradition. You must strive with utter concentration, single-minded devotion. You must be completely wholehearted if you want to make any progress on this path. And again, I think it's one of those things that we can so easily shy away from. People are so concerned about being willful. Well, if we're willful, it's probably because we're not doing the preparation. I know for myself. This is, by the way, a lecture to me. It's not a lecture to you. I'm talking to myself. I have trouble with meditation and being single-minded and not being able to strive with utter concentration because I live a distracted life. And with this wretched internet and email that's coming, it's even worse. I live a distracted life. So there isn't that utter concentration. You notice going out to Kukhiloka, 2 weeks away from all that, nothing like that. How easy it is to strive with utter concentration. Do you remember the advice Bhante gave to new and old order members, or was it old and new order members? Reduce input. Still relevant. Reduce input. And by input, I would also include talking about the movement. Movement gossip. Which seems to happen online a lot these days, you know, and, you know, talking about, I'm very concerned about, so what? What? Mind your own business. Get on with your practice. Be single-minded in your devotion. I've noticed so many times in myself, oh, I'm very concerned about, why are you concerned? That's worldly concern. It's because you're anxious. It's not because you really have compassion for these people and you really care about them. You're a busybody. Get on with what's important. Arloka, very interesting going to Arloka's studio. He's got painted up in different places. Mind your own business. Mind your own business. Your own business. So there can just be utter concentration on the work. It's the same with meditation. But it's also, I think, a counter to doubt. Doubt and indecision. You know, that so often, you know, when people, issues come up with people, I think I ought to go to another teacher or I need to take up another practice. For me, they haven't decided. They haven't decided to live the Dharma life fully, completely, totally. For me, that's what it seems to me. You need to decide that this really is it and you're going to put yourself into it one-pointedly, wholeheartedly. No inspiration is going to come near you if you're not one-pointed and wholehearted. It's just not going to, you know, the goddess of inspiration, the Dakinis, really won't come if you're not one-pointed. We were studying here on an at-home. We had a terrific at home a while back, we did the root verses of the six bardos, and we did it over 6 days. So we did a bardo a day for 3 hours a day. Really good study, some of the best I've done. Everybody stuck getting stuck in and really looking at it. And when we were doing the bardo of taking rebirth, I read out in Guillaume Dorje's translation the descriptions of how you have to close the womb door. When you're being blown by the winds of karma, very expressive, blown by the winds of karma to your next rebirth, seeing your mother and father copulating and all that, which is actually a very ancient Buddhist tradition. It's not just Tibetan, that goes back to Vasubandhu in the Abhidharma Kosha. I mean, of course, this is our life. I mean, forget the Bardo Tadol and that myth. How much are we being blown by the winds of karma to our next, shoddy embodiment in this life? How much, we talk about spiritual rebirth. Well, we're being reborn all the time. But is it actually, is the next rebirth in the next few moments, is that going to be any good? We're being blown by our habits, our winds of karma. But there's always a chance, there's always a choice, there's always a gap, there's always a bardo. And the Lama, the spiritual friend, the Tibetan Book of the Dead is a book of friendship, actually, because it's a friend, a Lama, whispering in the ear to the dead person to guide them to the next life. It's an act of Kalyanamitrita. He keeps saying, now is the time to decide. Now is the time to strive with utter concentration. Now is the time to remember the teachings you learnt in this life. Now is the time to go for refuge. Page after page of now is the time. It's urgent. Don't squander it. Don't waste it. Now is the time. So perhaps if we have developed these qualities of humility, devotion, fervour, and single-mindedness, perhaps then the lineage of inspiration that flows, has flowed from our teacher. I certainly feel that in touch with the inspiration that flows from Bhante, even after all these years of being an order member. For me, the most important point in my life was when I was 19 and when I was ordained. At that time, I felt an energy, I can only describe it in that way, was activated. To use the word inspiration, I think would, it depends what you mean by inspiration, but it was something much more sort of manic than that, it felt like at times. You know, remember that poem of Bhante's, The Wind? He talks about the wind being manic, driving him along, as well as leading to times of great calm and peace. And so on. Well, I felt at the time of my ordination that being initiated, going for refuge, being given my name, being really seen by the man I most revered more than anybody in the world, more than anybody that I could ever meet, activated an energy that goes on, whether I sort of like it or not. It's not always that pleasant to respond to it, but it's there. And that's why I always want to be with Bhante, really. Always want to have him in my heart. So I'm going to end with a prayer that I say every day at the end of my practice. It's the prayer that concludes the Guru Yoga. This is translated by Bhante according to the oral explanations of Dada Rinpoche. And I'll end with this prayer. And hopefully some of the things I've said might have said, communicated something about what the lineage of inspiration might be. O my own immediate Sri Lama Rinpoche, abiding within the lotus of my heart, may you never separate from me, but on the contrary remain inseparable. Grant me siddhi of body, speech and mind. Throughout all births, may I have an excellent guru. And from him never separated, may I practice the Sri Dharma. And fully accomplishing the good qualities of the path and the bhumis, may I speedily attain the Vajradhara state. From this evil mind of mine speedily liberated, may I speedily become the Guru Buddha, and may I lead all beings without exception to the Guru Buddha's abode. O Sri Guru, as are thy kaya, length of life and abode, and thy resplendent lakshanas, so also may I be.